Our guest today is Steve Clapham, founder of Behind the Balance Sheet, an investment research and training consultancy, and author of The Smart Money Method, a new book that's ranked number one on Amazon's Guide to Investment. Steve spent some 20 years as an equity analyst at different investment banks covering various sectors. He was consistently rated in the top 10 in his sector. He moved to the buy side in 2005 and was a partner and head of research at two multi-billion dollar hedge funds. He specialized in using a thorough research approach to identify opportunities often overlooked by others. Steve's frequently featured in the press, on podcasts, BBC, radio, and is a regular on Real Vision talking about accounting issues at quoted companies. So you've probably heard his voice before. In this chat, we take a brief look at Steve's career, a look behind the balance sheet, and take a dive into his fascinating new book, which draws on his extensive experience. This is another HR Resource podcast. You'll be well advised to invest in.
HR Resource with David Lord and guests. They love talking about people, but in a good way.
I'm delighted to welcome to today's HR Resource podcast, the one and only Steve Clapham. Hello, Steve.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Steve's here to talk about a number of things, I've got a personal interest in. I know a lot of our audience will be very keen to hear of Steve's experience and his latest book, which we'll get to shortly. But first of all, one of the things I like to share with our audience who may not be as familiar with you as I have been, doing my research for the podcast, of course, can you just give me a bit of background to your career and how you arrived at this particular point in this very interesting and very well-lauded book?
Well, I've been an investment analyst for many, many years, and I started off as an accountant, then I became a management consultant, then I went into the city. I was a stockbroker for many years, and then I moved to the hedge fund world, was a partner, head of research at two multi-billion funds, did the same role in a smaller fund, which we ended up closing, and I decided to become a trainer, an educator. So my main business is I train professional analysts at major institutions, and I then decided that I would do some courses for private investors, and they seem to be pretty popular. So I set up an online training school. You can find that on my website, behindthebalancesheet.com. And I thought, well, if I write a book, then more people will hear about me and I'll be invited kindly on podcasts like this. So here I am.
Well, and you're very welcome as well. I think I said to you, this is confession time, by the way, Steve, I said that I was going to try and get to read the book. I've actually downloaded it on Kindle. I'm going to get to it. I will read it. I've seen some of the headlines, seen some of the run-through of the book, and I've watched some of the other reviews. And I'm really looking forward to getting into that detail. But the business that you talk about in this podcast is titled The Man Behind the Balance Sheet, because I love that, by the way, as a title for a business or for a podcast even, which is why I chose it. But that, for me, explains an awful lot of my experience in business about people not really, I think this is what you do. You help people to better understand numbers, to get behind some of the mystery. And I think as humans and people in business, we fall into a couple of very broad camps. There are those people who just out and out say, I don't know numbers. It's not my thing. I'm not very good at it. That's for somebody else to deal with. And others who just, it's food and drink. Absolutely love it. I was talking to my previous guest, was Dame Stephanie Shirley, who's a mathematician, who, you know, was working on the early computer with premium bonds people, way ahead of some men in terms of her mathematical genius and ability to program. That was something that was second nature to her. And then you've got the people in the middle, I think, which is sort of like this sort of the hybrid elements that like to think they perhaps know something about it, but they're perhaps the dangerous ones. They're the ones that don't go for the right advice, don't get the right support, and end up making sort of strange statements and observations, and get themselves maybe in situations like we found ourselves with, I don't know, Patisserie Valerie. You know, there are some examples where some spectacular things have happened in business, or for the fact of people not properly understanding or being effective in due diligence with numbers. Has that been your experience?
Well, I think the important thing for your listeners is to remember that if you're in the business context, and I'm talking really about businesses, if you're in a business context, if you don't understand what is generating the cash, you don't understand how your profits are being built up, then your business won't be as enduring as it will if you do. And so what I teach is a process to analyze businesses, which is designed predominantly with an investment purpose, which has at its core understanding the numbers. But this isn't just about, you know, being able to invest your own money in the stock market. This is applicable to anybody who wants to get on in a business career, because if you don't understand all facets of a business, you can't rise to the top.
Yeah.
But you can get away with not being great at marketing as long as you can figure out who's a great marketer.
Yeah.
So I was looking this morning at the Weetabix advert, and they'd done this Weetabix advert on social media. Yeah. Where they had a recipe for baked beans on toast, but instead of toast, they had Weetabix. And they pushed this out on social media, and then they had Heinz responding, saying, we don't think it's a very good idea, and then Tesco, and you know, it went viral, it was fantastic. So you don't need to be able to create that to understand what's good, you know, what's going to be effective in marketing. You need to be able to understand who will be good at that. But when it comes to the numbers, if you don't understand the numbers, you don't need to know how to produce a set of accounts. You need to know how those accounts are produced. You need to know what's behind them. You need to understand what they mean. And if you don't understand it, your opportunity will be capped. So if you're a young person going into a career in business, finance is at the heart of business. And so you need to understand all these principles. So what I teach, although it's predominantly designed for investors, it's actually got much, much wider application. And, you know, I've got a course called, you know, how to read a balance sheet and all the other financial statements. And we've got investors taking that course, but we've also got a bunch of people that are just trying to understand. I've got one guy who's the chief executive of a company, and he said, I've never understood the numbers.
Yeah.
I didn't like to tell anybody. So I'm doing the course because I've always felt it was a weakness and a source of discomfort. And what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to educate people in a way that's not really done elsewhere. Because if you want to do a course on accounting, the courses that you can do are all designed around becoming an accountant. There aren't any courses for people that want to use financial information. And it seems slightly odd to me. I mean, maybe there are a few, but certainly none like mine. It seems very odd to me because there's 10 times as many people want to be able to understand a set of accounts as want to be able to produce a set of accounts.
Yeah.
So that's all I'm trying to do.
And from what I can see from the reviews, doing it very successfully. So that's the reason why we wanted to talk to you, because I think what you've got to share with us is something that's invaluable for most people, certainly entrepreneurs. And we've got quite a few number of, you know, entrepreneurs who are on the our membership in our community. And obviously, we're not going to, you know, the elephant in the room in terms of where we are right now. It's fantastic to see there's a chapter or a section in your book that covers this, the pandemic, which we can probably get to. But for you personally, how has it been over the 2020 and into 2021? What impact has it had on you?
Well, you know, faced with a major change like that, you know, every business has to adapt. So I did one course in January, and I was launching a program. So I wasn't taking on a lot of work, and I had a lot of work stacked up in February, March, April. And all of those courses, with the exception of one, which was done by a colleague, every single one of them was cancelled because, you know, I predominantly worked with large investment banks, large investment institutions. And I mean, one of my clients, they banned anybody from coming into the office. I think this was as early as February. Wow. And, you know, we were in the middle of a program, which I was training, I think, 84 people in that organization. And we got one third of the way through the program and we just stopped. And we still haven't resuscitated it because they don't want to do it via Zoom. So what I did was I placed much more emphasis on my online school, so the B2C business rather than the B2B business. And I've been spending more than 50% of my time on that in the last year. And we didn't do any courses on Zoom until probably July, August time. Okay. Because, you know, nobody knew what was going to happen. So we're all in lockdown, everybody's trying to adapt, and training, you know, it was just shoved to one side. You don't need to do it. But then around June, July, there started to be more interest in doing training courses via Zoom. And what was quite interesting was that whereas until now, or until then, my business had been predominantly UK-based, and in fact, we designed a program to build out internationally in 2020, and we had a program set, which obviously we didn't do, but program set to go into Europe and then into the US. We shelved all that. But I started, I think the first course that I did via Zoom was with a business which had an office in Singapore, an office in London, and an office in the United States. Wow. And I did a course over 3 weeks where we did a session in the morning, a session in the afternoon. So the people in Singapore did the morning session, the people in the States did the afternoon session, the people in London split, depending on what their schedule looked like, between either the morning and the afternoon. And of course, you know, you couldn't have done that before. And I've done, you know, in the last couple of months, I've done some courses in the UK, but I've done courses, I mean, from the US to Asia to Brazil. You know, I've just done a course with a billionaire's family office. He's got, I think there were eight analysts in his family office. He's obviously very wealthy and he's got a big team. And I did a course for them on how to improve their investing skills.
And how do they find you?
I don't know. I mean, they...
That's the marketing bit. Obviously, the pandemic's been a bit of an enabler in terms of more and more people going online. And yours is a skill base or skill set and a knowledge base that a lot of people have thinking a bit like the CEO. You know, I really wish that that's something we need to be better at. We need to understand. So obviously they're finding you. Something's working for you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously the launch of the book makes you much more visible. And I've done several podcasts in the launch of the book. And I'm pretty regularly on Real Vision, which is a financial streaming channel, which if you're interested in investing and you want the opportunity to listen to a bunch of very serious macroeconomists, a bunch of very serious hedge fund managers, Real Vision is a fantastic resource for that. And they do a trial, which I think is $1. Don't know how long it's for a month or something. But you know, for $1, you can go back and watch a whole bunch of different videos. And I've been on that quite a lot. And I did an interview with Kyle Bass. So Kyle Bass, a very famous Texan billionaire hedge fund manager who made, I don't know how much money in the global
crisis. Is this the guy that outstrips Buffett? If you look at the time spans, I mean, this is the guy that...
Kyle's not, he's not been investing that long. He's probably been doing it 15, 20 years. Like anybody outstrips Buffett in time.
I just mean in terms of his how long he's been working, if you compare what he's done in the time that he's been doing it.
Now, Buffett's the longest by far. Buffett's track record's over 50 years. I don't think there's anybody even close to that. Might be 30, I think, would be the next one. But Kyle Bass is very famous, but he made a fortune in the financial crisis, and he's very public. And he does a regular... He often does interviews. He interviews people on Real Vision. Yeah. And I published a report on the Chinese tech stocks that he was interested in. So he interviewed me. And they've now released that on their YouTube channel, and last time I looked, it had 18,000 views. So that's, you know, I mean, that's marketing that you can buy, right? I mean, you could, you
know, gold dust. Yeah, fabulous. So what I'd like to do now, because of the style and tone of podcasts, is that a lot of people, a lot of hosts will have an interesting conversation and it starts, you know, well, and it goes all the way through to the end. And then they give the guests an opportunity to talk about where they can find them. But people don't consume podcasts necessarily that sort of linear way. So I'd like to give an ad break now, an opportunity for you, Steve, just to let people know how they can find you. I know you mentioned very briefly your website, your Behind the Balance Sheet, but perhaps a little bit more about, you know, the links for the book and links to yourself.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, you can find me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at Steve Clapham, as in Clapham Junction. I'm sure most of your viewers or listeners are in the UK.
My daughter's.
My website is behindthebalancesheet.com. And if you're interested in the online school and online training, if you hit the first tab is private investors, then that takes you to the online school. And there's also a sign up button on the front page and the home page. And if you join our mailing list, you get a monthly newsletter and some stuff in between. I'm not very diligent about sending them out, but we're going to do more this year. But more importantly, that gets you into our club. And the club site is a subdomain within the main website. And that's very interesting because we've got 1,500 different articles on investment in our library. So there's a library, it's all free. We link to, I don't know how many fund letters we've got for Q4, but probably for Q3, we've got over 100 letters from different hedge funds, long only funds around the world. And the most interesting thing, I think, on that site is we've got a free training area. So there's different, it's a little community, there's different spaces within the community, and there's a free training area where you can go in and, you know, I'll write about different aspects of investment, do little videos.
Sure.
And like I say, it's all free. And there's a forum where you can, you know, you can post stuff that interests you or you think might be interested to other people, or you can ask questions in the community. You know, somebody may answer you. And this is just a spin-off because I use this community for my courses. So if you sign up to my main course, which is the Analyst Academy, which is a 12-month program, which takes you from being not very knowledgeable to being a proficient, competent investor then, that's got a whole community within using the same software. And so I've just created a space for the public and people on the list.
So then they get subscribed into that community.
You know, the idea is that, you know, it's in its early stages. I haven't had a lot of time to actually build it up, but we'll revamp it in the next couple of months. And I think it should be a good resource. We've certainly got fantastic information there. You know, if you want to read about great investors, you can read, I don't know, there's probably 10,000 pages about Warren Buffett. I mean, I don't suppose anybody will read all of them, but, you know, if you were doing a study, if you were doing an academic study, then, you know, in one place, you could find a whole lot of
it. Great resource, fabulous. Now we're going to take that dive into the Smart Money Method, which is your new book. And what I'd like to understand, I know you touched on this at the very beginning, but just to focus on who the target audience is, who you think the target audience is or should be for this book?
Well, I mean, I wrote the book for people who are interested in investing, for young analysts going into a job in asset management. And that was the person I had in mind. So, you know, when you start as a young analyst, well, how do you learn? And, you know, it's quite an interesting topic. How do you learn how to invest? And so one method is to read a book. So the Smart Money Method, How to Invest Like a Hedge Fund Pro, slightly cheesy title. But the idea of it is that you can read that book and it has constructive, practical suggestions that you can implement to improve your investing technique. But there are lots and lots of books about investing, but very few of them will teach you how to invest. And the best ones have been written by great practitioners. So Anthony Bolton, Investing Against the Tide, great book. One Up on Wall Street by Peter Lynch. Now, you know, I'm not comparing myself to Lynch and Bolton because they're obviously been amazing investors, but the techniques that I show people are similar in concept, and they're the practical techniques that I developed over a lifetime of being an analyst is how to analyze companies. And, you know, loads and loads of people have emailed me. I mean, over the Christmas period, I was emailed or DM'd on Twitter every day by somebody saying, I've finished your book. It was fantastic. It's full of nuggets. And, you know, the thing that's most flattering to me is people said, oh, it's really easy to read. So it's not like a turgid textbook. Because I've got lots of anecdotes about my career. Unfortunately, I've got non-disclosure agreements in place with my former employers, when I was a partner. So I'm not allowed to give the practical examples that, things that I did at the hedge funds. But, you know, I've put in enough there that I think it's still pretty rich. And people seem to enjoy it. An interesting thing is, you know, how do you learn to be an investor? If you go into, you know, when I started, I just learned from listening to the bloke next to me. You know, there was no such thing as a structured training program. And if you go into a big bank, they've got structured training programs, but they're not very good at teaching you the anything other than the theory. And the practice is difficult and it's important. And, you know, how can you learn? Well, you can learn from books a bit. You can learn, I think, a lot from podcasts and video interviews. I think they're very helpful. But I think the way forward will be more and more people will learn a craft, a profession like this through online courses, because they're an incredibly effective way of educating yourself.
Well, it's quite clear I'm no expert in this particular field, but so I might ask some questions that are a bit nugget-like myself, but so forgive that. But one of the questions would be, if people bought this just to sort of manage expectations, if people go in, they hopefully download or acquire this book now through Amazon and various different sources, does it do away with the broker, the sort of intermediary? Is it sort of like, all right, that's it, you're set, you're off on your own, or is it not quite, it's a bit more subtle than that?
Well, I mean, if you're using a broker, a financial advisor to advise you on what stocks to buy, generally speaking, they make the decisions for you. If you're using a broker to advise you, I think this is a good idea, what do you think? Then you're effectively making the stock selection decisions yourself. And then the book will be a fantastic tool to improve the quality of those decisions. If you've never bought a share, then the book will help you reduce the number and volume and value of the mistakes you'll make.
Yeah.
But the only way to learn about investing is to make mistakes.
Yeah.
So what the book will do is instead of making mistakes over this wide a field, it will narrow, you know, it'll take out those extreme losses on both sides of the distribution, and it'll allow you to make fewer mistakes, and will teach you to make more detailed analysis, so that the value of the mistakes, when you make a mistake, it won't cost you as much money, because it won't be a 90% loss. Because if you follow the process in the book, you won't get sucked into a fraud. Well, I say you won't. I mean, obviously, you know, it's always possible, but you'll be less likely to.
You touched on it. It was a question I was going to raise, so I'm going to bring this in now, the process, because I think I've had the opportunity to write a book, a very sort of niche book, but it was about generational diversity. And in my book, I followed a process as in looking at a business and the approach you would take from, you know, right from the beginning, recruiting people in, whatever age they might be, all the way through to succession. And I get the sense that you've taken a similar approach with your book in terms of logical progression of steps that you would take. Could you perhaps walk us through how that the main headlines of that topic, the process?
Well, It goes through my methodology of picking stocks. So, you know, it starts with, well, what makes a stock go up? Right? So you've got to understand, why would a share make you money other than the stock market going up? Obviously, that's a primary driver.
Yeah.
But then it doesn't matter which stock you buy. And I then go through, okay, so you want to invest in the stock market. What do you have to do first? You're going to find an idea, haven't you? Right. So how do you find an idea? And I go through, I don't know, a dozen or 15 different sources of ideas. And I say, you know, some of these are good and some of these aren't. And I explain, you know, where to look. Not specifically, but in the generality.
Yeah.
And so, you know, where have my best ideas come from? And I then say, okay, so we've now found an idea. What next? And as a professional investor, what I used to do is, you know, I would have lots of ideas. And what I would do first is I'd try and validate which were going to be the winning ideas. So I would try and do a first review, which eliminated things that weren't worthwhile. And then it also eliminated things that would take a long time. Because as a professional, and indeed as a private investor, what you want to do is you want to do things that are manageable. You don't want to spend, you know, I would spend, you know, several weeks researching a stock. So that's a huge investment. But then we were investing huge chunks of capital.
Yeah.
What you don't want to do is you don't want to invest 6 weeks looking at something and then find at the end, oh, there's something we can't check and we can't go ahead. So, you know, what you do at the start is you figure out what are the main areas you need to look at and are there any issues that are going to cause you a problem? So, and then you would prioritize what you were going to look at. So if I had a trip planned to America next month, I might look at this US stock rather than an Asian stock because I wasn't going to Asia for 3 months, but I'd do that after. You know, you never know. The stock may move as you do your research and you may have to abandon it or, you know, accept that you've just missed the opportunity. But you can try and prioritize so that it fits within your schedule and your circle of competence. And I emphasize this in the book that, you know, everybody knows something about something, right? You might not be an expert, but you probably are an expert at something, right? So if you're an expert at something, if you're a software developer, the tech area, software is probably a good place for you to look at because you understand the business.
Yeah.
And so I go through those sorts of things. How'd you find the idea? How'd you test it's a good idea? And then I go through valuation, looking at accounts, looking at the macro and so on.
And I guess that there's, and everybody's different, so there could be a lot of people who are interested in taking a step into investing and doing it for themselves, some experience in the past, or maybe it's for the first time. Everybody has a different propensity for risk. So do you give any guidance on that in terms of step, or is there a nice little disclaimer somewhere in the book about, you know,
There's no disclaimers. There's a disclaimer in my website. The disclaimer in my website says something like, if you lose money because you've followed something we've said in the website, you're an idiot. That's what it says in the website, right? I don't want to be sued by anyone, right? That's the only reason I've got a disclaimer. But everyone has their own propensity for risk, you know, and what I just try and explain in the book and in the courses is that the best way to make money is to get rich slowly. And people who promise that they'll make you rich quickly are either charlatans, crooks, liars, or are subjecting you to unreasonable levels of risk.
Yeah.
Nobody likes losing money, you know. It's, you know, we've got the loss aversion heuristic in behavioral finance, and a loss is twice as painful as a gain, as the equivalent gain. And, you know, everybody suffers from that. Nobody likes losing money. And the more you try and make fast money in the short term, inevitably, the more likely you are to be taking significant risk, and therefore the bigger the chance of creating that loss. And what I advocate is that you try and make money slowly. You buy sensible things that are undervalued but don't have a huge amount of risk.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of my students in the courses are people that are engaged in, you know, a lot of the UK students are people that buy small caps. And I do a presentation at a small cap investment forum every, couple of times a month now, and at the moment when we're in lockdown. But, you know, it's some sort of monthly thing, and I give them some investing tips and so on. And they all got very upset when I started talking about liquidity. And I said, you know, you're running a massive risk investing in small cap stocks. And oh no, I've always made money. The fact is that small caps, if it goes wrong, you can't get out. That's a simple matter. Once it goes wrong, you're in there, and you're gonna wear your loss. And that to me is a very, you know, high risk strategy. So my attitude is, stock market goes up over time. You can do better than the stock market if you're a sensible private investor. And the easiest way to do that is not lose money. And low risk strategy.
What you're teaching really is born out of your own hard-won experience. Do due diligence, but work within the scope of your own knowledge and experience. If you find something you've got a particular interest in, or you've got knowledge already, or you know people that are in that industry, you've worked in it, then find a way in which you can explore it to a way, the methods that you are suggesting, to be able to understand where the risks lie and mitigate those. And if it looks too dangerous, if there's something not quite sticking up according to your guidelines, then obviously don't do it. And it's this sort of heart over head, you know. a lot of people who get carried away with things like, and it really frustrates me, things like Bitcoin. You know, the logic of Bitcoin and investing in that and buying that, and people get carried away with it. It's been carried away with some sort of weird gold rush. But if it looks really easy, it's supposed to be an easy way to make a lot of money very quickly, then it probably isn't. That's the very simple logic that I'd take with that. You have a view on Bitcoin? Is it just a...
Well, I mean, there are arguments for and against Bitcoin. I mean, Bitcoin as a cryptocurrency is probably the most liquid, easiest one to get involved with. I mean, I have a personal problem with it because when I went to buy Bitcoin, I had to deposit money in a bank I'd never heard of.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, that
red flag
isn't really what I like to do, you know, because I don't know if I'm ever going to get my money back. And that seems to me a big problem with an investment, because kind of, you know, my starting point is don't risk 100% of the money.
Yeah.
But there's all sorts of long and complicated arguments about Bitcoin and Ethereum, all the other cryptocurrencies. And, you know, Bitcoin certainly getting traction even with institutions. I mean, Jonathan Ruffer, whom I know and I've met several times and I've got a huge amount of respect for. I mean, Ruffer has been a buyer of Bitcoin last year. Mm. You know, they are people that I respect and think are serious investors, and they wouldn't do it if they thought it was just a fad, you know. So, and similarly, Patrick Collison of Stripe has invested in Bitcoin. Patrick Collison and his brother John are two of the smartest guys. You know, if you listen to anything that Collison says in an interview or writes, I mean, he's a genius. You know, so, you know, I wouldn't say, oh, you mustn't invest in Bitcoin, because there are people who are doing it, who are making good money, that there are logical reasons behind it, and people who have done a lot more diligence into it than I have, because it's not, you know, it's not within my remit, really.
Because it deserves that level of, I mean, as it's relatively new technology, a relatively new product, it deserves that level of investigation and that knowledge and experience to be able to really make sure you're not overly exposed. But in my experience, I had a bit of a bad experience with, and I managed to get my money back. But the reality is, there's so many scams and schemes, pyramid selling opportunities that seem to have been born out of Bitcoin that I think have proliferated. But at the heart of it, as you say, there is an opportunity if you know what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, it's just a function of the supply of fiat money, tail end of a bull market. You know, there's all sorts of signals. I mean, it's obvious why Bitcoin's going up, right? It's going. I mean, you superimpose the chart of Bitcoin and the chart of Tesla; they're almost identical.
Yeah, and in terms of going back to the book and looking at other areas where you might get support in doing this, is there some technology or software products that you might recommend for private investors to invest in?
To invest in or to use?
And to use.
To use. Well,
throw money to buy and to use.
I mean, you know, I've had approaches from various people offering me affiliate deals, and in fact, I've done a couple of them. But what I tend to do is I do an affiliate deal, and then my students get the benefit of that because I rebate them for the commission that I make. And I'm not really in the business of recommending things so I can make money, because I think there's an inherent dishonesty — is too strong a word — but lack of transparency that I don't really want to be associated with, because I don't want to be seen to be taking money off my subscribers,
right,
by pushing them into products. So I'm not really keen on doing that.
A particular software package? Or...
Well, I'm not really keen on doing it, because I mean, I've been asked to do some work with one particular provider, and they've given me an affiliate arrangement, and I'm offering that to my students, and I say, saying to them, look, do a trial and make sure it's for you. I don't use the package myself. Right. So it's very difficult for me, honestly, to recommend something that I don't use myself. And I use a product which is more than 10 times as expensive.
Yeah.
So, you know, I do promote the product that I use myself because I think it's a good product. And I do it because I think it's a good product. And I think, you know, my students should be interested in it. But maybe I'll change my view. I mean, the only affiliate deal that I really practice is with Amazon. And so I took an Amazon affiliates account when my book was being published.
Yeah.
Because I thought, well, I'm going to send all these people to buy my book, and I'm getting not very much money from the publisher because I made the mistake of using an established publisher rather than publishing it myself. I mean, I say I made a mistake. I mean, the publisher was fantastic, but I did a lot of the marketing work myself. But I thought, well, you know, I'm not getting paid very much for each book I sell. So if people are coming to buy the book from my website, I may as well get an affiliate deal. They're not paying any more. All I'm doing is taking money out of Jeff Bezos' pocket, which makes me feel quite good, actually. And I'm donating the money. I'm donating the money to charity. I'm donating the money to charity anyway. I decided that I would do that. But stuff associated with the book, but I'm not keen on recommending things other than things that I've, you know, I use myself and I think people will genuinely get benefit from.
Okay. And you touched on there the publishing of the book, which is interesting. One of the challenges I have with my book is quite a niche publication in the professional service sector. And the cost of each book was prohibitive from my view. They wanted to market the book in hundreds of pounds, which I thought, given the nature of what I thought the content could serve, it was going to very much limit the audience, as proved. I've had three publications. And the next time I do one, I'm definitely doing it myself because of the relationship and the constraints. I just want to try a bit of self-publishing if I can. For the process with you, and obviously you've got a publisher on board and a very well-respected publisher. And you talked about the fact that despite that, you've done quite a bit of the marketing yourself. How have you found the process?
Well, you know, I was slightly naive when I started this, because I've never been involved with publishing before. And I was, you know, very pleased when Harriman Haas offered me a contract. And I was so pleased, I just signed it. You know, I didn't negotiate or anything. I thought, well, I couldn't. But, you know, subsequently I've become, you know, better known. They call it in the publishing world, you have a platform. Yeah. And, you know, they did a very good job in the editing. The editor was fantastic, actually. And they did a great job on the cover. I think they did a great job on the cover. Interestingly, I surveyed my email list and said, which cover do you like? And the initial reaction came in and everybody liked the cover that I liked. And then by the time we had a few hundred responses, it was actually split, almost identical. But they did a great job on the cover. But when it came to the marketing, I was slightly surprised because I'd assumed that they would line me up, well, you know, with book tours where I went round signing books in bookshops, of course.
Insurance kicks in and it just sweeps you along and you just follow that process. Yeah.
I don't know if it would have been any different if we hadn't been in lockdown, but there hasn't been a bookshop open since my book's been published. There probably was for a period, but I never actually made it to one. But, you know, I've done the marketing myself. And I think, you know, a lot of people that were talking to me through the course of last year as I started online school and became more obvious, obviously available to the world, they were keen to look at the book and talk to me about it. And, you know, we sent the book out to, I don't know how many, but, you know, quite a lot of commentators, and quite a few of them said, oh, we'd love to interview you with this. And just to be clear, I mean, Harriman had been a fantastic publisher. It's just, you know, a naivety on my part that I didn't know what to expect. I didn't realize that I would have to go and email people and say, can I come on your podcast? I've got a book out. I'm going to send it to you. What's your address? I assumed that they would do all of that. But they, you know, they send out a press release and, you know, you're in the press release in tray with 1,000 other, or inbox with 1,000 other press releases. Quite hard to get known and seen unless you already have a name. It's just that catch 22 situation. But if I were to do it again, I'm wondering, yeah, I might do it. If you'd asked me this a month ago, I might have said I'd have done it myself. But in actual fact, we've just had the first three overseas deals, which I would never have got myself.
They've got the reach.
And obviously Harriman have got the contact. So the book is going to be published in India. I'm going to get the square root of nothing for that. But, and then, you know, interestingly, I've had two or three people email me from India saying how much they enjoyed the book. And apparently the book is 20 quid. I don't know how much they sell it for in India. Maybe a bit more than that because it's got to be shipped there. It's all done by a reseller.
Yeah.
But they said, oh, nobody would buy a book in India for £20. It needs to be sold at £3.50 because obviously it's a poorer country. So I've got to sell a lot of books in India to make any money out of it. But we've also done a deal with a publisher to translate it into Spanish. Okay. So it'll be sold in the Spanish-speaking countries. Again, not. They weren't very ambitious on the number of sales. And we've sold it to a Korean publisher. And the Korean publisher paid more than I would have expected. So that'd be quite fun that it'll be published in Korean. And, you know, obviously the Koreans are mad keen on education. The kids are learning all day long. I mean, I don't know what their school day is, but it seems like it's more than a 9-to-5 job being a school child in Korea. And presumably this carries on to people wanting to learn about finance. So we'll see.
Fantastic. And in terms of versions as well, I mean, I've got the Kindle version. Is it an audio book as well? Have you done an audio version?
Yeah, the audio book, I don't know what's happened to it because it was scheduled to come out very close to the publication date, but Amazon have got some sort of problem with audiobooks and there's a backlog. And so I don't know when. I was expecting it to be out already. I had to audition the narrators.
Oh, but that was fun.
Oh man, some of them were just awful. And there was one very good guy, but he had an English accent. And I just thought, you know, this book, the audiobook, is going to be a bigger seller in America. because they're more into audiobooks in the United States than they are here, I imagine. And I just thought nobody's going to understand them. So I ended up going for this very cheerful American who's all, oh, I have no idea how wearing it will be, you know, when by the time you get to page 100, but, you know, I don't have to listen to it. So we'll see how well it sells.
Multi-platform. That's the way these days, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the way it works is that they audition various people, and then the narrator gets a big chunk of the audiobook revenues.
Okay.
And it's quite lucrative. Now, funny, after I decided and we'd commissioned this person, one of my pals said to me, oh man, I would have loved to have done that, English chap, but he said, I've always wanted to narrate a book. And I said, well, if you'd only told me earlier, happily you could have done it.
You'd have had to burst in. Brilliant. So in terms of the difficulties, and I did actually find when I was Googling trying to find you, there's actually a title of a book that's identical that's out there. You're obviously aware of that. It's a good title to pick, and so it has obviously been there before. But from what I can see from the reviews, there's an awful lot of positivity. You've had some fairly high profile praise as well from, is it Investor? Oakley has said some good things about you as well on Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, Phil Oakley is an associate, I think he's an associate editor of the Investors Chronicle. In fact, all three of the guys that produced the Investors Chronicle have reviewed the book, and they've all said very nice things about it. And it was, you know, incredibly kind of them. But Phil bought the book. I mean, he paid his own money for the book. And then he just tweeted out that, you know, he said, thought it was one of the best investing books he'd ever read. And I was like incredibly flattered. I mean, I know Phil. I mean, I've met him a couple of times. He's not like a great mate of mine. But, you know, if I saw him in the street, I'd probably wave, or I saw him at an investment conference, I'd probably wave to him or say hello at least. And I was, you know, really pleased that he did that. And then he asked me to go on. They've got a podcast, and so I went on their podcast. But they don't normally interview people. They normally have a podcast about the markets. But he interviewed me about the book. And, you know, it's very flattering when your peers, you say nice things about you. You know, I hadn't really expected that.
It's, I suppose, justification, isn't it? For the effort, for the time, for the years' experience that you put into it, that actually other people are thinking the same way. I always think there's a lot of cases in business where you get the sort of emperor's new clothes moment, where people are sort of looking around for thinking everything's fine, everything's great, everything's wonderful. And there might be one person there that actually doesn't actually see it that way and probably is quite correct. And with finance, I think that happens all too often. There's a final point I want to get to, and I really value your time today, but the piece on the other side of the coin, when you are investing in businesses, obviously you look at how those organizations are set up. If we've got some entrepreneurs that are listening into this, if they want to prepare, if they're looking for some investment, they're looking to take their business out to you know, receive interested parties to invest in their business, what should they do? What's the best way to present their business to have them? And there's the obvious things about make money, you know, prove that you can actually deliver. But what, in terms of presentation, in terms of approach, what should they be thinking about?
You mean if they're trying to raise capital?
Yeah.
And what, I mean, depends what sort of business. I mean, if it's venture capital, it's very different from capital for an established business. I mean, if it's venture capital, which seems to be the biggest area of growth these days, the thing that I tend to look for, and I'm quite active in the venture capital area, is the founder. You know, how good is the founder and how committed is he? So don't say, I'll get back to you, I'm going on holiday, because that's a bad thing to suggest that you're going to take any time off. But if it's an established business, I mean, I think the numbers matter less at the venture end, because it's more about the probability of success. Yeah. You know, and if it's a successful concept and the founder is able to drive it through, then the numbers will follow. And you can't really predict what the numbers will be. So people worry less about that. obviously you want to know that it's going to be a product that can sell at a profitable price, but you know, how many you're going to sell is less significant than when you're an established business. When you're an established business, what you've got to demonstrate, I think, is an understanding of the two key elements. The first is return on capital. How much you have to invest in this business in order to generate profit. And the second is, how cash generative is it? And if you can demonstrate a clear understanding of those two concepts, then you'll be in a much better position to attract money from investors.
And what, I hate Chris, like one thing that we could take away, but in terms of business advice generally for you, Steve, what has somebody said to you, or maybe one of your early mentors or colleagues, what somebody said to you, you've read, that has helped guide you and you would follow in terms of a philosophy in running your businesses and being in business?
Well, I think the main principle that I follow was given to me by my dad. And he said, if at first you don't succeed, try again. And, you know, I'm running a B2C internet business is very different from what I've done in the past. And so I'm still in a massive learning curve. And whenever I have a setback, I just remember that advice and, you know, just keep going. Yeah. If you keep going, you'll get there then, right?
And I think if nothing else, the last sort of 12 months have shown us that there are going to be setbacks. And I think it's on a mass scale at the moment. But that philosophy is one that we should be taking to our hearts. But thank you very much, Steve. It's been a fabulous run through a number of different areas that you've got, but the book in particular. I'm really looking forward to sort of diving further into that. The reviews, quite often when it's like the Trustpilot thing, which I'm not a big fan of personally myself, but when you look at the Amazon reviews, usually they're quite good and quite telling. And I would urge our listeners to have a look at that, because a lot of people are saying a lot of good things about your book, and I'm really looking forward to it. I appreciate the time today. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Find out more and join our growing business community by visiting hresource.co.uk.